Introducing two new Subway melts. Try the new chicken cordon bleu melt stacked with juicy chicken, black forest ham, and melted cheese. Or the new $5 footlong chicken marinara melt. Tender chicken covered in marinara sauce and melted cheese. Melted goodness made irresistible. Subway melts. Subway. Eat fresh. The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Yeah. All right, it's a special Evergreen Holiday edition of the BS Report. We're taping this on Tuesday, December 22nd. So if anything weird happens in the time between when we tape this and it actually runs, like, for instance, Tiger Woods escapes from the law and leads a whole highway chase down the I-10 or something. We didn't know about this at the time. On the Subway Fresh Take hotline, our old pal, a Mount Rushmore BS Report guest for me, Chris Connolly. What's happening?
That's very kind of you, Mr. Simmons.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
After you're on this kind of like Malcolm Gladwell, Chuck Klosterman run, you know, I think of myself more as the fight that goes on right after Sugar Ray Leonard has knocked a guy out.
Come on, it's high IQ holiday week.
Clearly. Well, those guys are bestsellers, you know.
Well, I'm just
a pre-internet crank.
You've had the most interesting resume of all four of us. You got that going, at least.
Well, I'll submit my CV to whoever's hiring these days if I ever need a new job.
So, Tiger Woods.
Yes.
Not really dying down yet, but I think the world does need your take. You were here for OJ in 94. In your opinion, biggest sports story of the decade?
It seemed insane to say that, doesn't it? Because we've had a whole decade. But as we've seen in every area, in music, in movies, in film, people are grappling for how to sum up the decade in the same way in all areas. It just seems, in the same way, we can't even find a thing to call the decade, you know? It's like sand through your fingers as opposed to the previous decades, which seem to have some sort of stamp. So it seems remarkable that something that happened in the last couple of months, the last month of the decade, would win the prize. But as you pointed out, and as others have said, for sheer conversation starters, for the thing that at any party two people start to talk about, and then you've got four people and five people, and each has his own opinion, I don't think there's been anything like it.
Yeah. I don't remember if I told this story in the podcast before, so if I did, Joe Mead, cut me off, and I'll start again. The day I handed in, like, 10,000 words about Tiger, those two columns, like, I actually felt like I wasn't totally happy with the fact that that happened. You know, that I was like, not what I don't like to typically play that kind of, you know, all the different scenarios. I didn't feel great about it. It was a little TMZ-y for me. But at the same time, this is what everybody was talking about, and this is the biggest athlete of this decade. So anyway, I went to lunch with my friend Ben. We went to this great sushi place in L.A., and we were talking about Tiger. And the guy and the girl next to us, the tables were close together, and I could tell the girl was listening to us.
Right.
And we're talking about Tiger, and I could tell it's one of those things where now I'm like afraid to really say everything because I don't know if this girl is like Tiger's lawyer or what's happening.
Sure, yeah, or a crisis manager or something like that.
Yeah, or whatever. So like 4 minutes in, all of a sudden she interrupts us, and she's like, I got to interrupt. I'm obsessed with this story, and just jumps in. And now all four of us are talking, two complete strangers. And I can't remember the last time that happened to me at a lunch where somebody actually interrupted my conversation to get into it who I didn't know.
See if that happens at Nate and Al's when you start talking if Brett Favre's going to retire if he wins the Super Bowl.
Right.
Not going to happen.
Yeah, Michael Vick and Pitbulls, nobody's interrupting my conversation unless it's like a PETA, you know, a PETA person, and I'm talking about how the dogs deserved it. I mean, that's like Jennings the only way I'm getting interrupted.
Yeah, that's not going to go over so well.
Right.
Jennings versus Evans, just not the same thing, no.
Yeah. So anyway,
I on the checking line for the, you know, the Columbus Blue Jackets. It's not that much a thing. But and, no, you can get anybody into the conversation if you go there.
And the last time, and this is obviously...
And of course, Tiger is thinking, if only Tom Watson had won the British Open.
Yeah, he would have been so much better off. But the last time I remember a sports story in that magnitude, and it wasn't even a sports story, it was OJ, where it's like, that was the last story that I remember somebody interrupting my conversation.
Right.
Like just jumping in, feeling like we're all kind of in this weird story together, and what's your angle, and what's your take, So there, it does have some of those elements, I will say.
Yes, and it obviously is reminiscent, too, again, with this, in the same different way that O.J. was, because, you know, fortunately no one died, you know, in any of this.
Right.
As the Michael Jackson death earlier this year, you know. That was the kind of thing that set off any number of conversations in different directions, because there were so many different angles to follow. You know, there was the doctor, there were the drugs, there was the music, there was the family, there were the children, and... In any group of people, you could wind up having a conversation about something that interested you with regard to Michael. And Tiger seems to have hit the same zeitgeist button, you know, although we have to remind ourselves without anyone leaving this mortal coil.
Well, the Michael Jackson story, obviously bigger.
Right.
And when you take that combined with the Tiger, pretty big year.
For random celebrity things.
Yeah, I mean, I got to rank that one, too, with almost anything.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you're competing against Mel Gibson talking to the Malibu Police Department, you know, I'm still going to go with Britney shaving her head, though. You know, I talk to paparazzi, you know, for stories I do in 2020, and it's like talking about, you know, a perfect season. You know, it's like talking about the Mets in 69 or Arsenal's Invincibles or something like that when you go to a paparazzi. Boy, fall of 2007. Unbelievable, right? And they get this misty look in their eyes and they say, we made hundreds of thousands of dollars for 6 weeks of work just for hanging outside Britney's house. She'd do anything. You never knew what she was going to do. So
went off the deep end. I still think for celebrity stories, though, I don't think anything's going to top Angelina stealing Brad Pitt from Aniston.
Well,
that was the perfect storm of a celebrity story.
You think so?
I mean, yeah, I really do.
Well, I think what you would say. You know, there's so much talk in terms of how to manage Tiger's future, and a lot of the crisis managers are, of course, saying he needs to change the story somehow. You know, there was that piece in The New Yorker that said it's a mistake for him to not go back to playing golf because by playing golf, he changes the story. He moves it along, you know.
Yep.
That story that you're talking about, the Brad and Angelina and Jennifer Aniston story, seems to be the same story now as it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago. It seems to have just been frozen in time. It's like going to a museum and looking at an insect in amber or something like that. The same tropes get played out on the same covers of the same magazines. It's like that Men's Health thing they just found where all the cover heads on this month's issue of Men's Health were the same as they were from October of 1997. It's like that could be true for any celebrity magazine with regard to those three.
So you're saying like it would be the Jennifer flips out, late night phone call with Brad, Jennifer upset something, but doesn't really matter.
And somebody's waiting for baby. Somebody's getting ready for baby. Somebody wants a baby. Somebody's talking about a baby. Somebody heard a baby in an airport. Somebody saw a baby. Somebody's thinking about getting a baby.
Well,
all the familiar elements have all not changed in 5-6 years. That's the surprising thing, you know. Usually things move on, you know.
And
Tom and Katie Holmes get together and they have a baby and that changes things. Or, you know, everybody has transformation in their life and we have to talk about it a different way. But that story is right where it was. I don't know if that's a comment on the audience or on what seems to sell in terms of those stories.
I would say that it's a comment of the best kind of story that resonates, which is, because if you're really going to get a woman invested, you have to have the element of a second woman stole the first woman's boyfriend or husband. You take that, just that one little piece right there, and that's going to go on for weeks and weeks and weeks.
I remember from my childhood that the Eddie Fisher Richard Burton, the Eddie Fisher,
Elizabeth Taylor,
Debbie Reynolds triangle sold a lot of copies of Photoplay there for a while.
That was the biggest celebrity story of the 60s.
That was really massive. I think then Liz and, you know, you had Liz and Richard Burton, and then you also had Jackie. You had Jackie, you know, the widow marrying Aristotle Onassis. Those were pretty big, but you couldn't beat Liz.
I'm trying to think.
You're absolutely right. That was the role she was cast into in that triangle.
Was there one in the 80s? I'm trying to think. There must have been a version of that in the 80s.
Was Anthony Michael Hall involved? Was there perhaps a...
Atlas Sheedy.
Was there mischief on the set of Teen Wolf 2? I admit I don't recall.
But that's what makes that's the element.
I tell you one thing. There would have been shoulder pads involved.
Yes.
Big shoulder pads.
And bad
a
hair.
Large belt to pull it together. Because women in that era dressed like they were linebackers for the Bears.
Yeah. Oh, I thought of a good one. It's got a lot of mileage and nobody remembers it. I forget if it was Jason Patrick or Kiefer Sutherland, but one of them stole Julia Roberts from the other.
Well, it was a little more complicated than that, if I'm remembering correctly. Because, remember, Kiefer and Julie were going to get married on the Fox lot. And the marriage was going to be paid for, I guess, by Fox. I don't know. It was going to be on the lot. It was going to be a whole deal. And then, like Ernest Biner, there was a fumble on the goal line.
Right.
And the next thing you know, she was seated on a park bench with Jason Patrick.
And they dated.
They did date for a while. Remember, he always wanted to make that movie about George Gipp.
Right.
That was the movie he always said he wanted to make. But yes, they did. They did date for a while. So
that's a bigger story now because we have more magazines and we have TMZ and stuff like that. That gets more mileage now than I think it did in 1990 or whenever it happened.
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure if it happened now, it would be gigantic. You know.
I also think that if Michael Jackson, Lisa Marie Presley. Post-molestation trial, that whole thing, that gets analyzed like the Zapruder film if that happens in 2009.
I think people felt like by that point that they didn't really know either individual, and it was such an unusual situation. There was almost no precedent for it. I remember being at the MTV Video Music Awards the year they came out and they said it wouldn't last. And then they kissed. And then they left the stage. And Ed Marquez, who I think was a VJ at the time, we were all sitting in the MTV talent section. And they left the stage. And Ed Marquez leaned forward and said, "What was that?"
and that's still the reaction.
And if you could put that on the front of the wedding album, you know, if you could just engrave that, like instead of the date or the names of the people, that would have been just fine. Imagine what was that, you know, and then turning the page and we begin to see the wedding album.
Look,
that's kind of how it would have worked.
Watch that clip on YouTube now. That's still the reaction. That reaction held up for 15 years. Hey,
Ed was a man of his time, ahead of his time.
You mentioned Britney. I think Tiger qualifies for this a little bit. I talked about this in one of the two columns I wrote about Tiger, about the effects of fame on people when they're not the person that they're meant to be. And you and I have even talked about this a little in a past podcast, but you know, a lot happened to Tiger at a really, really early age. And
he was in the public eye really early on. So
did we give him too much credit this last decade for maybe handling this better than he maybe was behind the scenes?
I don't know that there was any evidence otherwise. You know, people talk now in terms of the way he displayed anger or rage on the golf course and how that was outré or not done in golf circles. And I remember thinking it was a nice sign of humanity. It was like, oh, that's cool. That's like what an athlete would do. Look, he's mad because he hit a bad shot, you know.
Right.
He just did not give off the aura of a guy who seemed to be ruffled by anything, you know. I'm sure it's difficult when you're seen as being a shining light, when the world around you constantly confirms that you're different. You know, for you to resist the idea that you should take on the life that seems appropriate, you know. So he didn't have his Tyson moment. I mean, I'm not comparing him to Tyson in any way. Or his Britney.
No, you just did. Don't say you didn't.
Well, okay. Well, the thing is that there's a moment when young people in the public eye do everything that adults ask them to do, right? They do, you know, they're very compliant. And they get praised for being compliant. Look, she's not rebellious at all. He wouldn't rebel if he knew. He's just not the rebellious type. He does everything his mother, his father, his manager tells him to do. Isn't that great? And that's, I think that's very hard for a child star, because I think at one point you're going to blow out of that. You're just going to blow out of that. You're going to, like, do what it is you want to do, whether the world sees you do it or whether it doesn't. And there are always consequences when something like that happens.
Maybe we don't think about athletes enough as child stars. Look at LeBron. Who's more of a child star than LeBron James? Guy's famous when he was 16.
You know, the interesting thing about LeBron, as you, I think, pointed out, is that he has attempted to reposition the concept of the posse. Right?
Yep.
He has, all these guys are really solo performers. You know, we talk about Britney, we talk about Tiger. We don't know a bunch of guys who hang out with them, you know. I'm sure there are on some level, but we don't think of them as having steady entourages in that kind of way. You know, LeBron reinvented the idea that an entourage could be a good thing, a grounding thing, a thing that sort of kept him from spinning out that way.
Well, and beyond that, these guys realize, I think, some of them don't realize it in time. He seems to be somebody that realized it almost immediately that, you know, the only people that were going to treat him like the kid that he was before anything happened were the people he grew up with. That could be a good thing and a bad thing, though, because the bad thing is when we see this a lot where somebody lets their cousin run their business.
Exactly.
And that's when it gets dangerous. But in LeBron's case, it seems like he just lucked out. He's got what seems to be a smart group of friends that have his interests in the best, in their best.
We certainly hope so. We certainly hope it stays that way. You know,
I think he's handled it amazingly. The
annals of show business and sports are filled with the transformative effect of success on a group of old friends.
Yeah.
You know, that's the oldest story in Hollywood. We were best friends in film school, and we dreamed that someday we would make a movie together. You would be the director, and I would be the star. And then, 15 years later, we get to do that. Only our relationship is completely different now because Hollywood loves me and Hollywood doesn't love you. So while you think we have the relationship we had back in film school, I know that we have the relationship that we have in day-to-day Hollywood, and we're going to have a problem with that. And you see that a lot.
Yeah. Well, and then you also see it with musicians.
Very much so.
I think Simon and Garfunkel is the greatest example.
You know the interesting thing about Simon and Garfunkel? They're both the short one.
What do you mean?
I always thought Garfunkel was the tall one. They're both the short one.
Oh, they're both tiny?
They're both the short one, yeah. Garfunkel looks like Alvin Adams, only because he's standing next to Paul Simon.
Wait, did you see them in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Dak Sigma, maybe. With the blonde fro, is that closer maybe than Alvin? I can't remember Alvin Adams' hair.
The only person you could compare Art Garfunkel's hair to is probably like somebody like Anderson Varejao. It's got to have that Sideshow Bob kind of.
Right. It was a little less determined as it moved its way north, though.
Sure. you're in a different age demo than I am. Did you watch the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
I watched some of it, yes, I did.
When you see these guys that, you know, you remember seeing in their absolute prime, and it was like 30 years ago, and you're watching them play now, does it make you feel nostalgic, or do you think, they're probably hanging up at this point? What are your emotions?
I'm glad they're still alive and they're playing.
Oh.
I'm glad they still enjoy doing it, because I'm also from a demographic where the great rock stars were like the great Grand Prix drivers of the 60s. They all died.
Yep.
So if they're out there making music, I don't care if they have to be shot through the lens Angela Lansbury had during the last two seasons of Murder, She Wrote. I'm relieved that they're still up there singing. It doesn't change your memory, you know, and I don't think it messes with your memory. It's not like watching MJ in a Washington Wizards jersey or something.
Right.
You're just glad they're up there and they still like doing it, because they wouldn't be there if they didn't like it.
Were you blown away by David Crosby? That he's alive?
I once named David Crosby Man of the Year when I was at Random Notes of Rolling Stone. And this was the days before TMZ and before all this coverage, when if you came out every 2 weeks, you could be the first person to tell the world what was going on with David Crosby.
Right.
Believe me, in the early 80s, there was a lot going on with David Crosby. He was the first guy, I think, to go over the wall at a rehab facility.
Really?
There was a gun involved, so... We're grateful that he straightened his life out, because he really was a talented musician. But back in the day, before he made Melissa Etheridge's Baby, he was very good business for the writer of Random Notes and Rolling Stone.
I remember in one of the deleted scenes in Almost Famous, they're talking about how he's got some great pot, and then he casually, one of the guys mentions that it's David Crosby pot, and then the other guy's like, oh, it's Crosby pot? I love that they worked that in. Crosby pot was like this magical pot.
The ultimate cherry on the sundae. Was that the idea?
Yeah. So. Wait, Chuck and I did a podcast, and we argued about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and what it really is. And I guess my whole definition in my head of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was that rock and roll was a specific type of music, and Chuck argued that it was all kinds of music. Where do you stand?
Chuck's right. The reason why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame exists is to reestablish the significance of the ethic that underscored the creation of rock and roll, which would be a bunch of guys sitting around in a garage or in a room getting together and trying to make music. Not a corporation picking a talent, not a corporation picking four people, but, you know, the old three chords and the truth idea, and that's the idea that has to be sustained. That goes beyond a particular type of music. So my ballot for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year was number one, ABBA, number two, Laura Nyro, number three, Donna Summer, number four, who was it, Genesis? Number four, Genesis, and number five, Kiss.
All right, well, here's my counter-argument. Here's my counter-argument. I think they've done a bad job of explaining that to people who are more casual fans, who just listen to music like me, I don't know anything about the history or who's in, or I haven't really followed it. And to me, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is loosely tied to, like, the Hard Rock Cafe and the guitar outside the restaurant and stuff like that.
No, I think of them as competing for the same precious pieces of memorabilia, you know?
Yeah. Never, like, when I saw Aretha Franklin at this 25th anniversary Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, I'm like, what the hell is she doing there? She's Motown. She's not rock and roll.
But a particular type of music doesn't need defending that way. What needs defending is, you know, is the idea that young people working together, you know, can make cool music all on their own. Whether it's Aretha in a room with Jerry Wexler, you know, going back to the Church, you know, whether it's the people who created Motown, whether it's Donna Summer even being the voice of a generation of disco with Giorgio Moroder. Like, that's the idea that has to be sustained, is that particularly after this last decade that was run from a popular culture standpoint by corporations. As opposed to the 90s that was run by individuals.
So
that's the idea that needs to be underlined.
So, but wouldn't it be easier if they just called it the Music Hall of Fame?
It's rock and roll. Rock and roll has that, you know, perhaps parodied, but still that sense of, you know, rebelliousness of putting it together, of, you know, it sounds like a cliche now. But it still stands for an idea, an attitude that, I guess, makes sense to a number of people still. And that's why, you know, hip-hop guys belong there and folks like that. So that'd be my sense.
If that's true, I assume Public Enemy is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame then?
I don't know that Public Enemy has come up for a vote yet.
Or what kind of rap or hip-hop act is in there?
I think Run DMC is in, if I'm not mistaken.
That would have been
sure when Tupac comes up, he'll, you know, he's likely to go in.
Because it was
not in this year. He's a reggae artist, you know.
It was a pretty white 4-hour concert.
Well, that's, you know, I'm sure that's true, but it's still fun to see Bruce and Bono and Mick Jagger in his suit jacket.
See, I argued this with Chuck, and I stand by it. And somebody sent a great counterargument, some reader in the email, that, you know, my whole thing is like, I wish that the genres were more defined, because I think it would be cool to have different Hall of Fames. It'd be cool to have, like, the, you know, typical rock Hall of Fame and the kind of music, the classic rock and alternative rock, indie rock. Then you have the hip hop, rap, soul Hall of Fame. Then you have the Motown Hall of Fame and all these different. It would be like baseball, football, basketball. The reader's point was that you can't define music like that. Music is music. It's not like sports where you can differentiate between Jordan and Babe Ruth.
That's right. A lot of our artists would really pose an issue with that. You know, are you this? Are you that?
Yeah.
Oh, what's Rage Against the Machine? What's, you know, what's Eddie? Is Eddie, you know, grunge? Is Eddie rock and roll? So, yeah. And also, you just need critical mass. You need to be able to say, this is where it is. This is who pays for it. This is who all gets together and jams when it's all over.
All right. Well, at the very least, then I think we use my pyramid idea for my book for this. By the way, I still have a book for you. I don't think I mailed you one. Did I?
I have my book. I have your book, excuse me, on my list to my in-laws.
I'll get your address
for Christmas. And
I don't know why you don't have one. I'll send you.
I have your book on my list. So I'm
you need to sign one. But in the book, I do the
Will you put that F. Howard Schultz on mine, too?
Absolutely. F. You
I'm
Howard
not
Schultz.
Asking for it. I'm just saying, is that your default signature now?
I had a few defaults. Like, I had there's some funny ones. Like, if somebody was like, I'm getting this, they just got engaged, I always wrote, welcome to hell. I didn't care whether they thought it was funny or not. I just thought it was funny. And it was such a weird gift to get.
In the 10 seconds people had to talk to you, they would say they were getting engaged?
Yeah, well, so we could help move the line along, we had them.
I'm just thinking, if I'm on the line to get the, you know, the premier book of basketball signed by the sports guy, the first thing out of my mouth is going to be, I'm getting engaged.
No, they would say for getting it for a friend as an engagement present.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, yeah. For a friend who's getting engaged.
Right.
No, that's different.
Yeah, they people that I'd have the sticker on the name because we, you know, or else we'd be there for 15 hours. But
yeah.
So they had the sticker of who was going to, and then they'd tell me quickly it's for this, or I'm a huge Red Sox fan or whatever. So the Welcome to Hell was the signature one. There was a few, though. There were some good ones, like, you know, some, I'm trying to think, of, you know, like if it was the Lakers, I had a few Laker ones, a couple that I won't even mention, a couple of obscene Laker
comments.
I'm proud
to say this was the first year I ever stood in line for an author to sign a book.
And who was it?
Daryl Strawberry.
Is that true?
Daryl Strawberry, I would say, set a house record for the Barnes & Noble at the Grove for how you doing.
Really?
I would say he spun out maybe 60 how you doings in 15 minutes.
I have a couple questions.
How you doing? How you doing? How you doing?
Well, I have a couple follow-up questions.
He looked great. And I've got it. And, of course, given Daryl's checkered life, the things he talked about in the book, I got it for the only appropriate holiday, Mother's Day.
Oh.
Gave it to my wife for Mother's Day.
First of all, Daryl Strawberry has a book.
Yes.
What is the book? Is it like an autobiography?
Is it like an autobiography?
Or is it an autobiography?
Maybe a, you know,
I don't know.
Buffett type book. You thought maybe a children's book?
Well, maybe like it's about him coming back from addiction. It's one of those addiction books.
It's a memoir. I would say it's a memoir.
Really?
I believe it was called Straw. And I believe it's his second memoir. Because I think I have the first one, which was written with the assistance of Art Rust Jr., back in the 80s.
That won the Pulitzer.
I think it was up for the Booker Prize, if I'm not mistaken.
I love that there was an Art Rust Jr. Because we had to differentiate between him and Art Rust Sr.
You look at Mel Kiper.
Who is Mel Kiper Sr.?
During when I had my talk show, we had Mel on for a whole week, and I refer to it as the highway to Mel.
So... You waited in line for Daryl.
I'll tell you that much. You waved the green flag, and he would give you great television.
You waited in line for Daryl Strawberry.
I sure did. Not the longest line. You
the
know,
Grove. That's a nice setup at the Grove.
It was
I was
beautiful.
Thinking, when did you go back east?
This time?
Yeah. When did this vacation?
Like right around the 19th, the 18th or 19th.
Because, you know, we went to the Grove on Saturday to see Santa, and... And it was like 77 degrees outside. And back home, my mom and my dad were preparing for a blizzard. And which turned out to be like 18 inches. And meanwhile, we're walking around this outdoor mall. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is why I live in California. So then I tweeted that, and I got some mean tweets from people back home who were like, you've sold out, or you've become a wuss from the weather. It's like, no, look, if you give...
Jealousy takes many forms, does it not?
Here's my counter. If you give the average person a choice between 18-degree weather or the sun and a blue sky, what are they going to pick? Nobody's going to go, you know what, I'll take the cold weather. I want to be cold.
Only if I'm watching a game that's live from Green Bay.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, so you're basically choosing the elements. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right, and you're watching at home, and you just think, this is great. I'm in this nice, warm room, and there they are. They're freezing out there.
But all right, let's...
Aside from that, I remember pitching baseball on New Year's Eve in Los Angeles to my son when he was 5 or 6. And we're in shorts and a T-shirt, and we're thinking, this is great.
Right.
Really nice.
You don't ever totally get used to seeing a Christmas tree in 78-degree weather.
That's true.
Like at the same time.
I don't think
time.
The Christmas tree gets used to being in 78-degree weather either.
Nobody gets used to it. All right, let's talk about some decade stuff.
Sure.
You mentioned earlier you don't think this decade is so undefinable that we won't even be able to come up with what we end up remembering it as. I think we're eventually just going to settle on the zeros, as boring as that sounds. I think that's where we end up.
It's less pretentious than the noughts.
The noughts won't happen. It's going to be the zeros. So in 2039, we're going to be like, oh, remember in the zeros when this happened? I think that's where we end up.
And the kids will go, yeah, I'm from the zero generation. Yeah, I'm a zero. I'm a zero from way back, right.
Biggest pop culture change from 2000 to 2009?
The Empire Strikes Back. Revenge of the Machine. Look at what the 90s represented from a music standpoint. I mean, we were touching on this earlier. Really bold, untraditional people succeeding without the help, at least initially, of the big bad corporation. The artists on Sub Pop from grunge, the artists on Death Row, Tupac and those guys. Even Lou Pearlman, who signed... You know, who managed NSYNC and managed Britney and, you know, all those young artists who were under contract at Disney at the beginning of the 90s and then had to leave Disney to be able to become solo artists. It was, in a weird way, in three different genres, the time when the corporations missed the boat. And now, in the 2000s, we've had the Disney Channel stars, Hannah Montana, American Idol. We've had popular culture created a lot less, at least on the music side, and I would argue also on the movie side, less by individuals and spiky individual perceptions than by big corporations. And in a weird way, as you and I have discussed, movies and television swapped clothes. The TV, which used to be seen as just kind of a faceless bunch of creators, is now the place you associate with all the things that you used to love about independent film or personal film. The Sopranos, The West Wing, Mad Men, The Wire, very much a product of the unique ideas of their creators.
Yeah, I'm with you. And even when movies try to be, I don't know, independent or whatever, it still feels like kind of rigged. Like I saw Brothers this week. Mm-hmm. It's like your typical independent movie that De Niro would have made in 1976 and John Cazale would have been his brother. Oh, okay. He would have been married to Meryl Streep and they would have made it for $10. Now it's like Tobey Maguire as an Iraqi vet. Jake Gyllenhaal is his brother. And Natalie Portman is his wife, is Tobey Maguire's wife in middle America. It's like, all right.
There are a lot of scenes in the kitchen, right?
A lot of scenes in the kitchen, and it's like Natalie...
Around the kitchen table.
I could almost hear Natalie Portman's agent telling her how great this was going to be for her career because it was against type. This would be great. You're middle America. You're stripped down, no makeup. It's going to be great. And then Tobey Maguire, like, just try and... It's like he watched Taxi Driver probably 120 times to prepare for this role. Of the brooding, about to flip out at any time, war veteran, and I don't know. It's just kind of stuck.
He's a vet on the edge. That's what you're saying? Is he a vet on the edge?
I kind of liked it as I was watching it, and then it ended, and I've gotten a little more mad every day, and now I hate the movie, and I don't recommend it.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm supposed to see it relatively soon, but I can't say I've had the pleasure yet. So.
Well, we're getting all these screeners because, you know, now there's 10 nominees per category. So every day we get like two movies in the mail.
It's a lot to have to do. It's like the way you used to have to listen to records, you know, when you'd stack up the five albums and they'd drop down one at a time.
Right.
You could do that with movies. Oh, look, it's Young Victoria. Look, it's An Education. Look.
Right. We have basically, you know, we can go in any direction, too. It's like, hey, in a Hurt Locker kind of mood tonight, honey? Or do we go with a little It's Complicated? How you feeling?
It'd be hard to... If you're getting in a Hurt Locker mood,
yeah.
I'm gonna suggest the paramedics surround that nice house of yours. it's a fine film, a really fine film, but it's, you know.
Did you see Into the Air?
It's not the laugh riot of the summer. Let's put it that way.
Did you see Up in the Air? I should say.
Yes, I did. I liked it.
Did you like Hurt Locker more or less than Up in the Air?
I liked them both. I think Hurt Locker had more. How can it not? More sort of gravitas. It showed you something really interesting that you'd never seen before in that way. I thought the first two-thirds, kind of like Up in the Air, were really the most distinctive parts, you know. In a way, they're both about the same things. They're both about heroes with no connection to any human being and who are trying to keep things from blowing up. George is trying to keep his fired employees from blowing up, and guys in the Hurt Locker trying to keep the bombs from blowing up.
Hey, save this for when we shoot our At the Movies pilot audition.
Do we have to sit in the balcony somewhere?
Yeah, save this.
Do we have to have a dog or a bucket of popcorn?
I want to have a
catchy line that ends our show. And now the bathroom is being cleaned.
I want to nod
and
at
now,
you.
Now the raisinettes are $50. That kind of thing.
I want to nod at you while I'm wearing an Izod. Here's how I think it plays out.
Some parts I liked a lot. Other parts I didn't like at all. That kind of thing.
Here's how it plays out.
With the head nods.
Clooney wins for Best Actor.
No, I don't think so.
Let me give you my whole thing.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Clooney wins for Best Actor. Jason Reitman wins Best Director, but Hurt Locker wins Best Movie.
That could happen.
And everybody wins.
In a way, I see it the other way around.
Okay.
I think Catherine Bigelow wins Best Director. But Up in the Air could win Best Picture. I think it'd be really cool for a woman to win Best Director. And Catherine Bigelow has had a really interesting career. Not to mention the fact that she might be up for an Oscar against her ex-husband.
Oh. Yeah, but now there's been an Avatar backlash already.
Did you see Avatar?
I haven't seen it, but I was at football on Sunday, and two of the people who were there hated it, and one person said he walked out. And these were smart people. These weren't like...
That seems a little extreme.
I thought it was extreme, but at the same time, they just said it's like all special effects and the story sucked, was the consensus from both people who had seen it.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
My sons liked it, but didn't love it.
Yeah. I think it'll fade out.
And respected it, but were not transported.
It almost seems
ungracious, you know, for a movie that costs that much. That, ironically enough, is uniquely the creation of its writer-director.
Yep.
That's the thing. It's like you think of these independent movies as being, you know, the pure statement of some... But that is James Cameron. For all the money that took, that's James Cameron. He would have done every single thing on that movie if there'd been enough time.
We were talking about Jerry Maguire once, and you were saying how one of the reasons you love that movie is because it was Cruz being Cruz again.
Yeah.
I felt that way about the Clooney movie. It was Clooney after 6-7 years of not being Clooney or being half a Clooney or, you know, having a weird mustache or being the Ocean's 11 guy. But this now he's chasing the girl and he's doing all the things that he's meant to do in a movie. That's why I liked it.
I think that's right, and it's a fully committed idea. Do we think that Vera Farmiga has had the greatest movie makeover in that film since Ann Archer in Fatal Attraction?
I mean, I thought she was the weak link of The Departed.
I'm sure you weren't entirely, you know, by yourself in that.
It was the accent.
Idea, although anyone would have been the weak link. I mean, Judi Dench probably would have felt like the weak link in that in that array of actors. But does she not look like a goddess in that film?
She looked and was, I thought, really good. I haven't seen all the movies yet, but it's hard for me to believe somebody was a better supporting actress nomination.
Have you seen Precious?
No, that's on the list. See, that goes back to the whole, are you in the Hurt Locker mood? Are you in what kind of... Are you ever in the Precious mood?
No.
Some
movies just have to go out. You just have to, like, take a deep breath and say...
You're going to grind it out.
I'm going to really get pummeled. I am going to take a swan dive off my sense of positive feeling towards the world, and let's see what happens.
It's like shoveling. It's like, you know, the snow's piling up and you have to get it done. And it's like, I don't want to get it done. I don't want to get it done. I know I want to see it. I know it's fantastic. It's impossible for me to believe that Monique is a best actress candidate. So that more than anything I want to see.
You know, I think every human being in the world who's heard that since Sundance last year, I think everybody's walked into that movie thinking exactly what you thought. And then you leave that movie and go, holy cow. Well, the two things you think are, holy cow, Monique's the best supporting actress of the year. And the second thing you think is, that Mariah Carey did a good job.
Really?
You see it and see for yourself. They found the perfect role for Mariah Carey.
So if Monique is best supporting actress, she beats out Vera Farmiga then? Because it sounds like that's
just a
freight train.
And Anna Kendrick from Up in the Air also, which is, in fact, you know, she's gotten more critics nominations. She's got more critics' awards as a supporting actress than Vera Farmiga has.
You know what's interesting? I didn't love her in that movie. And to me, that she was the... I don't want to say weak link because I really, really liked it. But if I had to say what one thing could I have changed about that, to me, that I would have loved, like... I don't want to say Natalie Portman because it's a cliche, but somebody a little more fun to look at on a 50-foot screen. How's that sound?
I thought she was great. I mean, I thought she paired up perfectly with him. I just thought she was the perfect sidekick to him.
I don't know why it didn't work
all energy,
totally for me.
No, you know, all on point, all that Tracy Flick kind of stuff. And the great thing about that movie is just the sense it gives you that no other movie has given you kind of up till now, which is that kind of, you know, the rapture of rootlessness.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing you do think only George could deliver the way he does.
Well, it's interesting that the character kind of mirrored him in a lot of ways. Because he's kind of aimless, you know. He travels between these Italy and here, never seems to have a steady girlfriend, and kind of seems one of those guys who could get up from his life and walk away. And that was kind of the character in the movie, too. I loved it. I mean,
it definitely used his ease in life in a way that the Ocean's movies have used also to more traditionally entertaining effect, and gave you both sides of it in a very compelling way. It was a really nice match of role to actor.
I loved
it. It's hard to imagine who would play that role 10, 15 years ago.
You know what? It would have been a bad Cruise role. It would have been those roles. Cruise talks himself into it somehow, and the director doesn't have any juice to stop him, and it doesn't quite fit for him.
I don't think there would have been enough stuff for Tom Cruise to do that he would have wound up doing that movie. I don't even think they would have shown it to him. You know, it wasn't, because it's not active enough.
Because it's a
part of the grace of it is the idea that he's the star, but he's also buffeted by everybody in the movie. And you've noticed stars, sometimes male stars, sometimes shy away from movies, doing movies where they don't dictate the action. Where they're not the hero, you know. That old Steve McQueen line, when they were trying to get Steve McQueen to do a particular thriller, and they were pitching him, and they said to him, now in this scene, the hero thinks that there's a bomb, and he cut them off, and he said, I don't want to be the guy who thinks. I want to be the guy who knows.
That's good. I would rank Up in the Air above Hurt Locker. I haven't seen everything yet, though.
It's an interesting, I mean, very different pictures, and they're in it for the duration. I mean, there's no doubt that we'll be talking about them as the Oscars come around in February.
I also think, Up in the Air is going to be a good rewatchable cable movie. Throwing that
kind
out
of jumping
there.
Into it. How does this end up, like, for you next to something like Michael Clayton?
Michael Clayton, not a rewatchable movie for me.
But so much happens in Michael Clayton.
So much happens, but it's one of those things you only have to see it once. And it also has flashbacks, which are deadly for rewatchability. If the same scene is in the movie twice.
Okay.
So it almost like doubles.
So you don't know what, you know, you don't know if you're at the beginning or at the end or in the middle, that kind of thing.
Just, you know, the one that I really thought was going to have a long shelf life was Dark Knight. And I've already, I can't handle Maggie Gyllenhaal. I'm out on that movie. I can't watch it anymore.
I saw you even named an award after her. Not after her, but she was the heiress of the award, right?
If that had been a reader saying, we were talking about it, or I wrote about it, I can't remember, but I was like, who would have been the best actor? I said Scarlett Johansson, but a reader came up with a better one.
Charlize Theron.
Would have been unbelievable in that role, and you really would have been upset when she was going to blow up.
Now, do you wish that they had kept Katie Holmes in from the first Batman movie?
I do not. Okay. Good segue, because that brings me to my next question.
You're right ahead.
Weirdest pop culture story of the decade.
Well, it sounds like you have a nominee. I don't know if I have a nominee at the top of my head, but it sounds like you have a nominee.
Well, I think Katie is in the five. It's in the envelope. It's getting read to the audience as one of the five nominees.
Doesn't feel like a winner, does it? It feels like there should be something. You know, I mean, you mentioned the Eternal Triangle. I think that would be hard to beat. But I'm still, you know what? I'm going to go with Britney 2007.
Me too.
Because Britney 2007 combined a number of unusual elements, you know. It combined that kind of Tyson sense of somebody completely losing their mind, going into the Tyson zone that you talk about. Mm-hmm. It combined the effects of new technology in terms of our ability to access this stuff, that we could literally watch her fall apart 24 hours a day, live streaming on our computers.
Not wearing
panties.
That
it caused this like dot-com-like boom market in paparazzo photographs that for 3 or 4 months, 30 cars followed her everywhere she went, honking, running into each other, and that she wound up crossing the Mendoza line and dating one of her pursuers.
Mm.
That's the thing that takes it completely off the charts. If OJ had gotten out of the white Bronco and announced that he and Al Cowlings were getting married, that's the only thing that could have topped that.
You left out two crucial things. One, all the crotch shots, which in the internet era, I thought pushed it to another level because you had all these horny teenagers Googling her. And then Kevin Federline gaining like 2 pounds a month from 2004 and then suddenly becoming like just a fat guy without any of us really realizing. And like, oh, my God. Oh, he's gigantic. What happened to Kevin Federline?
How about the wedding where the two sides of the aisle apparently wore jackets that said pimps and hoes? That was pretty good.
It's pretty good.
But the other thing I left out was, and this is different for people like Tiger, as we've discussed, and for other people who melt down, the enormous reserve of goodwill that people had for Britney.
Mm.
People still really cared about her. They wanted her to be happy, you know? And so amid all these terrible things that happened to her, amid all the laughter, there was still a throb of, oh, my God, I hope she comes through this okay. I'm so sorry this is happening to her. And that cranked it up to another level, too.
You know, I love those oral history books. I think that you could really write a good oral history book about, like, Britney's last 10 years, which is people weighing in. I knew when she shaved her head, like, there's so much happened that I don't even think people properly remember all the weird things that happened to her.
Yes,
Justin Timberlake
that
writing that mean song.
You're absolutely right. There's stuff that we take for granted about what happened to her that, like, you know, if you all of a sudden said, oh, by the way, one weekend in Las Vegas, she married her like pal from high school who she hadn't seen in 5 years.
Right.
Like, who had the same name as a guy in the Seinfeld cast.
Well, yeah.
Go, really?
I told you my theory about her, right?
I don't think so.
I think the wheels came off when she heard Cry Me a River.
Oh, yes.
That was a devastating. I compared it in a column. I said it was the white Hit 'Em Up. Which, the Tupac song about Biggie.
Yes. You call yourself a player, but right.
That song was devastating. And it was also like, basically like, you're a slut, you cheated on me, you know, you have no integrity, and don't call me again, and I'm going to embarrass you in front of 10 million people. And And also, this is a really good song. So it had all, and it just, I think it just demolished her. I don't think she was ever the same after that.
That's an interesting way to look at things.
Most underrated pop culture moment of the decade that you
Nipplegate.
Feel like didn't get its proper due.
Yeah. Your opinion. I say Nipplegate.
I think that got its relative due.
I don't think people understand that Nipplegate is what put Howard Stern on Sirius Radio.
And led to a lot of my problems with ESPN. It really did. And that, it was the tipping point for me.
I don't think people fully appreciate how that, like, was the first counter salvo in the culture war.
Yeah, it was. I could tell you firsthand.
It was so huge. And, of course, and it was, as you were referring to Brad and Jen and Angie, it was a perfect storm. You know, it was, in every respect, what happened, where it happened, who did it, how it happened. The culture war, which everybody, I think, had sort of thrown the towel in on, got a whole new life. And that's why you need a special receiver to listen to Howard Stern.
Yeah. That was also underrated in how it changed sports, because we can now no longer watch sports live. We watch sports now 8, 9 seconds after it already happened.
Is that right? Even I don't know that. Is that really true?
Oh, yeah. If you're watching a game like an idiot and fourth down being like, come on, guys, and yelling at the TV, we got to get this, you're yelling at something that happened 9 seconds ago.
That's pretty significant. You know, I seem to recall they did an entire movie called The Sting about something like that.
Yeah, you're right. That and Richard Reed blowing up his shoes and failing were the two most random things that had the biggest impact on people's lives. Because when you think like that, the Janet Jackson thing actually changed live sporting events to taped just because we saw her nipple.
Yes.
Like, what other thing could have happened that would have led to us going that route? It would really with nudity and that's it.
It had to be in that particular context. That's the thing. That's the thing that you sort of define that perfect storm as being. It's like there could have been a mistake, a crazy thing could have happened. But, you know, of all the crazy things, for the final gesture of this big superstar to be that. And right, by the way, at the crest of the TiVo revolution, too.
Yeah.
Right at the first moment when you could literally have one button and say, let's look at that again.
But missed the YouTube generation by about 2 years, though.
Right. Well, you didn't need to. That was the one event that everyone still watches. Remember, the last vestige of why I need television, as opposed to watching everything on Hulu or in any of the, is live sports.
Right.
The Super Bowl, things like that.
Two other weird side effects from Nipplegate. One is that nobody remembers that was an awesome second half.
Absolutely right.
The great second.
Absolutely
people are like,
right.
It was better than the Pittsburgh-Arizona second half. It was more exciting.
It was thrilling. It was absolutely great. It was two guys throwing haymakers at each other. It was tremendous. And you're right. That second half is in the witness protection program.
I went to that game. We left the stadium going, wow, we just saw one of the five greatest football games of all time.
And
we get home, and everybody's like, how about Janet Jackson? That was it. The game was wiped out.
Never happened. Most irrelevant reaction in history. It's like, you really did ask Mrs. Lincoln. You really did tell Mrs. Lincoln how great the play was.
Do people even know that Adam Vinatieri made a field goal to win that game?
Like, I'm sure Adam Vinatieri's agent knew. So did the Indianapolis Colts.
They remember
That's about it, though.
But they remember the Rams field goal. I don't even think the average person remembers at this point that he won that game with a field goal.
And right after that game, of course, was when Jake Delhomme was replaced by a double. So
The other weird side effect, which was a good one, is that somehow not only did Justin Timberlake emerge unscathed with no blood on his hands at all.
Amazing.
His career became bigger in a good way, and he was never blamed at any point for being the guy who ripped off the thing, even though he clearly knew that what was going to happen there.
Well, if you look at the tape, you will see that she is supposed to have a red leotard top, and that you can see that during the course of the dance number, she literally bounces out of the top. So that was an unforeseen circumstance. I think they didn't tell MTV they were doing that. That wasn't anything that was ever rehearsed. They proposed an ending to MTV, as I remember, and MTV said, no, that's inappropriate. We won't let you do that. And so I don't know this to be the case, but I think away from the guiding hand of the network, they came up with a new idea of how to end. But I don't think they did it after seeing what would happen during a dance in costume. And so if you watch it, you can see she's supposed to be wearing a red top, but she literally bounces out of the top during the dance, and that's why she was revealed the way she was. So it was just an unfortunate circumstance.
I still think it was rigged. That sounds great.
I mean, I'm glad he came through it in one piece, because tell me in 2000 that you and I would have said to each other, you know, that Justin Timberlake's an all right guy. He's funny on those commercials. You know, I like his music. He seems like he likes sports. He's a good guy.
Good SNL host.
You imagine saying that when he was in NSYNC?
It's another good segue by you, because I was going to say most improbable transformation in a good way last 10 years. I think he's clearly the winner.
Well, he's tied with Angelina Jolie. Remember where Angelina Jolie was?
No, but she had done Gia at that point. I mean, it was clear that she was a major actress going into the decade. Justin Timberlake was in a boy band.
She wound up legitimately standing alongside George Clooney and Bono as being responsible spokesman for the first time in a really serious celebrity, really successfully leveraging their celebrity for good causes. You would not have expected that in 2000.
You love Jolie.
It was associated with the things she was.
You were the biggest Jolie Kool-Aid drinker, I think, ever.
Bring on the vat. I'm telling you, I'll drink it right out of the pitcher. You don't have to pour, you know, that little pitcher that's got the smiley guy on it? I'll drink it right out of the pitcher.
I don't
Please,
feel
make me
similarly.
Another. Ooh, really? Bug juice? That's great, yeah. Pour
I would still put Timberlake above her. And is there a bigger musical star today than him?
Well, we were all asking who the new king of pop is after Michael died.
It's him. It's Timberlake.
And I guess it's him, but does your mother...
Prince of Pop.
Can your mother hum a Justin Timberlake song?
No, but I mean, when we talked about... one of the last times, Jerome, we were talking about, like, people playing the Super Bowl, and, you know, we got the Who this year, and, like, who are the kind of acts 20 years from now? The acts that are developing now that 20 years from now will have that kind of longevity, and I would say he's on the short list.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Somehow Snoop is on that list.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's most improbable. Like, I mean, definitely a good rapper, but not the greatest lyricist or anything. Like, I certainly never thought his career would be going strong in 2009.
Well, youth football and that name was just unstoppable. Everybody got that name. Your mother knows the name Snoop Doggy Dogg or Snoop Dogg, you know? Whole football thing was fantastic. He compared himself to Tom Landry in an interview I did.
Right. Most underrated pop culture incident or moment of the decade. I have a clear answer for this one. I'll be interested to see if you agree.
Go ahead and throw me one, and I'll see if I can counter your Federer-like serve.
I think the Chris Brown-Rihanna thing is underrated.
Hmm.
For somebody who is arguably, other than... I don't know how old Kanye is or what the age is, but under 25, probably the biggest male hip-hop with that whole genre. And now he's been basically blackballed.
Yeah.
And also was involved in an incident with somebody who was one of the biggest female. Like, that was the first domestic violence where both celebrities were really big at the same time thing. Has there ever been another one like that? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, there has. But,
who?
I mean, you could say Pam and Tommy Lee.
Yeah, but they weren't nearly at the level of Rihanna and Chris Brown.
Of some kind. It's not perfect that way, is it? I mean, the cultural historian would like to say after far too long in which a genre of music was insufficiently respectful to women, at last the chickens come home to roost. Doesn't quite feel like that. It feels like what happens when two really young people get into a much more serious relationship than their ages would really justify their getting in. And one of them acts indefensibly.
So if you're saying Jay-Z had then had somebody shoot Chris Brown, that would have made it. That would have been a satisfying enough pop culture story for you. So, I know, you just said
Jay-Z
that.
I want Jay-Z to shoot Chris. You know. I will say that Jay-Z is in the Justin Timberlake category.
Yes.
Jay-Z gets mentioned at the awards ceremony. Jay-Z gets to buy a table at the Golden Globes where they're passing out Greatest Celebrity Transformation.
I wouldn't go this far. I think he's this generation's Sinatra.
You're going a little far.
How do you feel about that?
You're going a little far.
Why am I going a little far?
I think he's at it. I think the breadth of his success creates any number of different types of admiration for people. Like, he is the role model in some respects for all the things he's achieved, all the places he's gone in his life. He's a role model for a lot of people. I think he articulates his own story really well. I don't know that he articulates the feelings of a generation the same way we associate Sinatra as doing.
Yeah, but so if it's not Jay-Z, then who is it?
I don't know.
He's the best candidate.
It was not necessarily a good decade for that kind of thing. You know, that's that Cameron Crowe scene. Who gets hoisted onto the guy's shoulders now? I don't know. Who says the thing to somebody that you can't figure out a way to say? I don't know who's doing that now.
Aren't you overrating Sinatra a little bit, though?
For that whole generation, like Springsteen, people pointed to him and said, that's how I feel. I was trying to figure out how I felt. That's how I feel. And that gave their feelings meaning. I think Jay-Z's working a different side of the street. Jay-Z's telling you, look what I've done. Look at all the stuff that I've pulled off.
Isn't that what music is now, though?
You take your hat off and you go, you're absolutely right.
It's kind of what you just described music, though, in this decade. It's not what's happening to us. It's more, look at what's happening to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
For the most part.
Pretty good decade for Beyonce.
That's why my favorite... my favorite songs of the decade list, but the music snobs are so annoying. Like when you do lists and they're like the people who, the baseball stat guys, like they just ruin it for everybody.
I'm kind of in rehab. As a music snob, I don't know that I'm in full rehab. I think I still use, I use snobbery on occasion, just to party. Just a party, you know. I snob just a party.
My favorite song, I think, of the decade, and I'd really have to think of it. I'm talking about not just that I like how it sounds, but the lyrics and everything, is the MGMT song, Time to Pretend.
Okay.
I love the lyrics, and I thought it kind of fit this decade. Okay. And I just think it's a really clever song, and it's cool, and it sounds good, and it's different, and it's unlike really almost anything we had this decade. And on top of that, the lyrics are awesome. And the lyrics kind of slip by the wayside in general with songs this year. But to me, that's the first song I'll think of other than The Strokes and right after 9/11. But for me, the kind of music I listen to. And obviously the Jay-Z album in 2003. And then Kanye in 2004. But,
I've escalated out of the demo, of course. So not only am I not a snob, I'm not even in touch at all.
You have kids, though. Don't they keep you in touch?
I do.
Don't they load your iPod with songs that you know?
I hear a lot of the Killers around the house.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of hip-hop, you know.
Say the decade, the Killers.
My niece is really good at that Flo Rida song, you know.
In 2004.
She can rock the apple-bottom jeans lyric, you know. She's making it happen.
In 2004, if you had... people would have put money on the Killers as being the band of the decade because it seemed like... And it just didn't really totally happen.
You know?
Because that album was huge, and it did all kinds of things. And
everything that the industry used to be set up, I mean, they're the type of band, I think, and I don't know that much about them, they're the type of band that everything about the record industry used to be set up to make into stars. And so when the record industry collapsed, it's a lot harder for guys like that.
Yeah.
That's why we saw the big brand names still succeeding when... U2's, Springsteen, those sort of guys going out there and still filling stadiums and doing all that, because it's just so hard to get over now without a big TV component, you know?
I'm throwing this at you next. Another decent segue, because you somehow read my mind of what the next thing is going to be.
It's a Kreskin thing. It's like that John Malkovich movie with Colin Hanks and Tom Hanks.
Weirdest out there point that you haven't heard before, and if I throw it at you, it'll at least make you stop and pause, and then in your head think of all the ramifications and all that stuff. I'm going to throw this at you.
Sure.
We have so much performing-enhancing drugs in sports.
Yes.
What if music? What if Bruce Springsteen had been on HGH for like the last 15 years and steroids, and that's why he was able to still play these concerts at age 60?
I think you have it backwards.
Yeah.
People talked about Gary McClain doing cocaine before the NCAA championship game against Georgetown, or the guys on the We Are Family Pittsburgh Pirates team using cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not going to enjoy a bunch, if I'm not allowed to enjoy a bunch of guys on cocaine doing something together, I'm going to have to stop listening to some girls.
Right. So you're saying in music, drugs, fair game.
They've been performing drugs all the time.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Jimi Hendrix career. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Grateful Dead.
But isn't that funny?
We were for performance-enhancing drugs before performance-enhancing drugs were cool.
And in a lot of cases, they were performance-dehancing. But wouldn't that...
Layla. I'll just toss that one on. Layla.
If it came out that Springsteen was doing HGH this entire decade, I think people would be fired up. They'd be like, good for him. No wonder. But in sports, it's like we're violated.
Growing out from in between his shoulder blades.
His forehead did look bigger. I did see that.
I thought that sort of James Caan hairstyle was... Yeah. No, I think they'd be all for it. Whatever it took to get him up there.
Here's a song about me and HGH. Here. It's about human growth hormone. The doctor gives it to me. That'd be good. I think the other big hidden story is the fact that Bono now has more hair than he did in 1983 and can actually get away with the close crop crew cut. Don Drysdale? He now has the Don Drysdale somehow. Has anybody ever pulled that off?
Drysdale only had a crew cut for a brief period of time. Drysdale had that Brill Cream, like, little flip comb over in the front. Is that what they call the cowlick? It's like that little thing that, like,
came
over the front. I remember that well, you know.
All right, so
you
maybe we'll call it...
Drysdale played on the same baseball team in high school as Robert Redford.
Let's call it the Keanu Reeves and Speed haircut. How about that? So
Wildcat.
Yeah.
So Bono, after years of wearing a hat in the 80s, now busting out the Keanu Reeves and Speed haircut. I didn't think that got its just due, to be honest.
He had very unruly hair back then, you know, and he went through a series of different colors, you know.
Yeah.
But like Bruce during the Born to Run era, you know, he kept it all under a hat. You know, because it made you a little easier to spot from a distance and that kind of thing. But then, yes, the glasses and the iconic, now the sort of iconic crew cut.
Who gained the most hair?
Johnny Blanchard is who I think of. I think of that.
Johnny Blanchard. Roger, nobody knows that. Roger Maris.
Roger Maris had the classic. Roger Maris in '61 had the classic sports guy crew cut. Mantle, too, but I really think of Maris as rocking the crew cut.
Maris was nice. Like, you just pictured him living in a trailer and smoking Marlboro Reds and fixing his flat top.
Maris, you know, he really didn't handle all this, didn't handle it well, you know. He really found the pressure and the attention very stressful and unpleasant to deal with. So I think it was actually very tough for him. And apparently the writers didn't like him very much.
No.
Told from the readings and stuff, and favored Mantle. So it's a difficult time.
It'd be like
if Albert Bell had been competing for the home run championship against McGuire and Sosa back in the day.
All right. You could have just said Barry Bonds, by the way.
Oh, sorry.
That easily would have worked.
Would that be less libelous? I think that's right. I'm going to go with Barry Bonds.
Well, I mean, you just could have said...
I'm going to go with Barry Bonds on that one.
You could have said it's kind of like the time Barry Bonds hit 73 homers in a season. And none of us batted an eyelash. Is there a story that we missed in this, what has turned out to be a 70-minute podcast?
Gee, a 70-minute podcast, which I should have done much, much, much more research before.
Are you kidding? You can ad-lib this whole thing. I think we hit every major thing, though, pop culture-wise.
I never would have thought that magazines, newspapers too, but magazines would be in such dire straits as we head into 2010. That's the saddest thing for me. Mm. You know, we grew up loving magazines, reading magazines, dreaming of writing for them, imagining the life we would lead if we were around a bunch of guys. I mean, that's what I grew up thinking about, and I was lucky enough to get to do it. And I can't believe now that it's going to be so hard for the next generation to do something like that. I think it's great that there are all these multiplicity of voices, that there's the explosion of the first-person singular on the web and stuff. But the difference is that those guys who wrote the sports sections at the newspapers and those people who wrote our entertainment magazines and stuff, because of their jobs, they got to buy homes. They got to have families. They got to send their kids to college. I don't feel like the people who are doing that on the web now are going to be able to do that in the same way. They're not going to be able to have full lives doing that the way the other guys did. I would never have expected that in this boom of information that we've experienced, that those things would be the casualties.
I'm with you on magazines. I thought it was going to happen in newspapers. And in fact, you know, the last part of the last decade, I was convinced it was going to happen. I just thought the web was going to win. I always thought there would be magazines.
Your podcast with John Walsh actually went into that in some fascinating degree also.
Yeah, I knew it was going to win. But magazines, I just thought, you know, it's 12 times a year or once a week or whatever, and you're going to be able to hire the best writers and all that stuff. And it just seemed like they were infallible.
Yeah, you're going to hold it in your hand. It's always going to be fun. You're going to look at the, you know. So the idea that those are fighting for their lives right now is very disconcerting. And maybe naively, I never saw it coming.
A prediction for next decade?
Oh, yes. I have predicted that FIFA will raise the crossbar 1 foot.
That's your prediction?
To allow for more scoring in soccer. You know, I love soccer. But I think I really love soccer. I've always loved soccer. Every game should be 4-3, okay? Right. Every game should be 4-2. They need to raise the crossbar 1 foot. So that's what I think is going to happen. Baseball, meanwhile, is going to break into Premier League and Championship divisions. They're going to get rid of the American and National League, and they're just going to rank them by payroll. And you're going to be able to go up and go down like you can in the British soccer leagues and stuff. But there'll be an actual champion who comes from the have-nots. And so Kansas City and Milwaukee and all those guys will have something to be happy about.
That's interesting. I think that's going to happen with hockey.
I like your idea for hockey more, though. I like
the two conferences
you're going to say, but the reinforcement of the regional idea.
The American conference, full-on Canadian
presence.
Yeah. A reader had a great tweak for that, which is your baseball idea, basically. But so you do that, but you keep 30 teams, but six of them get relegated each year.
Yeah.
And then for the two conferences, maybe to not go totally Canada. You put Buffalo in there and Minnesota and one other team that's right on the border, Detroit. Put all those, so then it's almost like you create this line across the map, above, below, right. And six teams every year are relegated. And that would be fascinating. That's an awesome idea.
The interesting difference between English soccer and our sports are the regular season counts.
Mm.
The biggest championship you can win in English soccer is the regular season championship. Why do our teams play 162 games or 16 games and the regular season doesn't count? Why does it not count at all? Does that actually make sense?
You just described the best possible way to fix the NBA and they'll never do it. The NBA should be a 60-game season with a mid-season playoffs and then a much bigger... That the players would be more rested. They're not going to be injured or playing four games in 5 nights. Like, baseball to me is a sport that isn't the continuity part of what makes it great, though? that you know every night the Red Sox are on or the Dodgers or whoever your team is, you know every night after night your team's on?
But shouldn't that matter? Like, I'm not making, you know, I saw somebody said that the 2001 Mariners were the greatest team of the, and you go, ha, that's hilarious. That's so funny, you know?
Yeah.
But if they were Manchester United, they would have won the championship. They would have handed them trophies. There would have been big things blowing confetti on them and fans cheering. It wouldn't have been nothing. It would have been a big thing. I don't know if we're right to not think it doesn't count for something.
That baseball is so, I don't see baseball. There's no sport more afraid of change than baseball.
And they've
got
to get
under
the hood. You sort of made the point. They've got to get under the hood and fix it, because it's only guys with my hair color now who will have the conversation about baseball.
Yeah, well, and it's become so stat-oriented now that you almost feel like you have to study for your exams to follow it. You know, like I can't just watch the Red Sox games and have an opinion. I have to, study all the on-base stats for every team and all the whips and the warps and all that.
As you pointed out, though, it's also nice when the guys in the team appear to like each other.
Yeah, that's good.
It seems to help them win for some reason.
I'm going to give you my prediction for the next decade.
Go right ahead.
It's not the prediction, but it's just a prediction.
All right.
I think we're headed toward an on-demand society. And it's going to be just more a la carte. And I think the Apple, the tablet that's coming out is going to change the way we read. And it's going to be a little of what we saw this year, where instead of buying an album, you just pick the best song. Like what we saw with Netflix, like what we're seeing with pay-per-view. It's just, we're headed toward a lot of pay-per-view and people not buying season tickets, but buying individual tickets. And all kinds of different things that I'm not sure how it's going to affect sports, because I do feel like the live audience of sporting events is starting to die off a little bit and nobody's really noticing yet. But we're going to see, you know, in baseball, they're able to hide it with the new stadiums.
Right.
And every year somebody's building a new stadium or they've had a new one. But so now what's going to happen next decade? All the stadiums are built. You're not getting a rush anymore from going to Camden Yards or Pac Bell or whatever. It is what it is. And also with the TVs getting better and with HD and with the fact that it's just everybody has a 50-inch TV now and it's just easier to follow sports from home. So why wouldn't you? How do you stop that?
And I think the other thing you're going to see is, what will be the first stadium to go JetBlue?
What do you mean?
Where every seat has its own video monitor, where you can rewind and go back and scan any play from any angle while you're at the stadium.
It's a great point.
Well, that happened, right?
These stadiums that were state of the art are now dated, because you're right. In 10 years, we're going to need wireless at the seats, and we're going to need a whole bunch of stuff. We don't even know where technology is going. I mean, look at this.
I went to Amherst College in the 70s, and when I was leaving, they were building a big computer center because everyone would go to the center and use the computers.
Yeah.
Maybe that will be the equivalent of Jerry Jones' big, you know, telescreen over that stadium. Instead of buying the big screen, you're going to be buying $60,000 for every seat.
Yeah. Well, look at this. We're talking on some weird internet connection. Told me this in 2000. I wouldn't have believed it. It's basically Pump Up the Volume with Christian Slater sprung to life.
Well, you know, we've got all, yeah.
Hard Harry here.
Mathis in that with him, right?
She was great. Loved her. Yeah. But I do think with this on-demand thing, it's, you know, in 2 years it'll change radio and people will just be listening to the exact type of radio show they want. They're not going to have to rely on these, you know, big market type stations or whatever. It's just gonna be, I want to listen to this podcast, and you click two buttons and you're listening to it. And I think it's going to change TV and everything. And it's just going to be people just being able to get what they like right away.
You know, it was, if you look at the decade, it's like it's action and reaction. It began with 9/11. Thousands of people died and almost nobody can remember a single name. Strangely, people have a hard time remembering the individuals who lost their lives that day.
That is interesting.
And so I think that has something to do with the explosion of the first-person singular that happened afterwards. Facebook, MySpace, Twitter. I'm here. Here I am. This is me. This is what I think. You will know that I was here because this is what I thought about stuff. I will not pass from this scene unacknowledged, with my views unrecorded. I will have made some sort of mark that I was here and that I had something to say. But for everybody to keep having their say, everybody to keep being able to have the first-person singular take on the world, there have to be communal experiences somehow. There have to be big movies and big TV shows, and there's going to be big sports, because what you want to chip in on is the big story, whether it's the Tiger Woods story, whether it's the Super Bowl, or whether it's Avatar.
Hmm. Wow, that got really deep. Joe Mead, that got pretty deep.
It always does.
Chris Connolly, a pleasure. Happy holidays.
A pleasure, Mr. Simmons.
Happy New Year.
The happiest of holidays to your wonderful family and to you.
And to yours as well. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Target the channel. Whoa.
Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
This concludes another installment of the BS Report. And with all the talk about sports, Bill Simmons neglected to mention this important news, which frankly cannot go unstated. Whether tailgating, watching the game with friends, or just really hungry, attack your hunger with Subway Catering. Piled high platters starting at $25, giant subs, cookies, drinks, and more. So find a reason to party, put Subway Catering in charge, and get busy feasting. Subway. Cater fresh.